Sometimes on Please Explain, we explore topics simply because they seem intriguing, like nanotechnology, for instance, whales, or how bees make honey. But then there are segments that we hope may actually change some listeners' lives. Today's area of investigation is diabetes, an illness many Americans have or are predisposed to without even realizing it. And I'm joined now by the co-directors of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia University, Dr. Robin Golland, an associate professor of medicine at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Dr. Ruby Leibel, who is also head of the Division of Molecular Genetics at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. Welcome to the show. Now, is it Golland or Golland? I'm sorry.
Golland.
Dr. Golland, how many Americans are known to have diabetes?
The number is changing pretty much daily, but close to 20 million Americans are thought to have diabetes, and about a third of those don't know that they have it.
That's a huge number. That's, what is that, about 7 or 8% of the whole population?
Yeah, and in some high-risk populations, the percentage could be even higher. And the high-risk populations would be African-Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and some Asians.
And do we have any idea of why they are high-risk? Is there a genetic thing?
Type 2 diabetes and type 1, the two main forms of diabetes, they're both good examples of diseases with a genetic underpinning, and then there's something in the environment that tips the patient into getting diabetes.
So there has to be something that triggers it? Otherwise, we could live a whole life predisposed without having it?
There's a lot of information that people who are at high risk for type 2 diabetes, the form we used to call the adult form, that with the improvement in diet and exercise, you could reduce your chance of getting it by more than 60%.
Dr. Leibel, can you give us a layperson's definition of diabetes? First of all, what does the word even mean?
The word itself, diabetes, means to flow through. And diabetes mellitus, which is the type of diabetes we're talking about, means sugar flowing through. So it comes from the Greek.
So is this something that people have known about a long time?
This disease has been known to mankind for thousands of years.
And many people in the African-American community call it sugar, because sugar is a key factor in this?
Sugar is a key factor in the disease. The body, in effect, overproduces sugar and is unable to use the sugar because of a relative or absolute deficiency of insulin. And that's what results in the excess sugar appearing in the urine and in the blood.
Has the NIH done a study on how many people may have it and don't know it?
So Robin actually mentioned this, that of the 20 million or so in the United States who have the disease, up to possibly a third of those don't know that they have it.
Well, how can you not know it, Dr. Golland? Aren't there certain things that make it quite obvious that you have a problem?
It's really easy to have diabetes and not know that you have it. We all have sugar in our blood, and a normal blood sugar is around about 100 milligrams per deciliter. And the symptoms that people associate with diabetes, such as urinating frequently, poor wound healing, feeling tired, they might not occur until the blood sugar is well above 200 or 250. So there's a lot of time in between a blood sugar of 100 and a blood sugar of 200 where the person feels absolutely fine, but the high levels of sugar in the blood could be damaging the blood vessels.
And since this is something that should be treated as early as possible, then it sounds to me like we're caught in some kind of a bind here.
Well, everybody, especially those over the age of 45, those who are overweight, those who are from a high-risk ethnic minority population, women who've had gestational diabetes, they should find out what their fasting blood sugar is and have it checked every 3 years.
Dr. Leibel, you're a pediatrician, aren't
yes.
you? So Dr. Golland earlier mentioned that we had these two types that we used to call juvenile and adult. Now don't use those terms anymore. Is juvenile diabetes, what used to be called juvenile diabetes, more likely to occur with young people?
So juvenile diabetes we now refer to as type 1 diabetes, and in the aggregate it is perhaps a bit more common for it to have its onset in childhood, and it represents maybe 10% of all diabetes in the United States. Type 2 used to be called adult onset. that represents about 90%. And what has happened very recently or over the past decade or so is that children are now developing the classical forms of type 2 diabetes. So of new cases of diabetes in a location like the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center, up to 25 or 30% of children presenting with diabetes may have type 2.
But you're saying this as though this is a new development.
This is a relatively new development and appears to be the result of of the fact that children are getting more and more obese more and more rapidly and earlier in life, so that it is now possible to see this disease that used to be very, very rare in children, that is type 2 diabetes, as early as 8 years of age.
How similar and how different are type 1 and type 2?
Type 1 diabetes is primarily the result of an attack by the body on itself and is often referred to as an autoimmune disease, in which this attack results in the destruction of the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. Type 2 diabetes is the result initially probably of increased insulin resistance. That is, the body still makes insulin but doesn't respond to it properly. And the main mechanism for insulin resistance is excess body fat.
So we have these two things that start very differently, but in the end wind up looking similar?
They look similar because in the end the metabolic disorder is the result of either an absolute or relative deficiency of insulin.
Dr. Golan, you talked earlier about testing for it. How do we test for it? And should everyone be tested for it?
Well, everybody over the age of 45 should certainly be tested, and it's a simple blood test in your doctor's office. Your fasting blood sugar should be under 100, and you have no way of being able to sense what your blood sugar is, so everybody should be tested, and people with the risk factors should be tested earlier, and some groups are suggesting as young as age 10, because left untreated, a high blood sugar damages the blood vessels. And the good news is that if we diagnose diabetes and keep the blood sugar close to normal, we can largely prevent the devastating complications that we're all so worried about: blindness, amputation, heart attacks, strokes.
Are most general practitioners knowledgeable enough to help their patients achieve good levels with diet and exercise and medication if necessary?
To manage diabetes properly is hard. That the rest of us, without diabetes, we eat when we want, pretty much what we want. We exercise when we want. And having a chronic illness requires a lot of vigilance. It can make people feel quite isolated and lonely. And it's hard. And we ask people to check their blood sugar, to moderate what they eat, and to be cognizant of when they exercise, how much. So it requires self-care by the patient and a dedicated team.
But I'm getting back to whether doctors are always adept in spotting this and knowing what to do. I've seen, for example, I know that pediatricians often are rather late to diagnose autism and some other things that should be pretty easy to spot. And I suspect that with something like diabetes, the same sort of thing might be happening.
I think it used to be more common that children with both type 1 or type 2 diabetes might actually be missed for a substantial period of time, apropos your question. And type 1 diabetes can actually acutely represent a life-threatening illness. I think physicians as a group are more sensitive to this possibility, so that the diagnosis is made earlier and children, for example, are referred to appropriate medical facilities earlier. So we don't see the so-called diabetic ketoacidosis nearly as often as we used to.
I'm talking with the co-directors of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia University, Dr. Rudy Leibel, who is also head of the Division of Molecular Genetics at Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons, and Dr. Robin Goland, Associate Professor of Medicine at that same school. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Some illnesses have stigma attached to them. Is that a problem with diabetes as well, Dr. Goland?
Diabetes is an illness with more guilt and blame associated with it than almost any other illness I know. I'm constantly faced in the office with a patient or a family who feel that it's all the patient's fault, blame the victim, and it becomes a big barrier in trying to take care of diabetes. So it's very important to teach the patient and the family that this is a genetic illness, that nobody ever that I know woke up in the morning and said, boy, I would like to have diabetes.
But people are blaming themselves because they ate more candy than they should have and things of that sort.
Absolutely. And I think the point we try to make is that just because a disease can be managed nicely with making some lifestyle interventions doesn't mean that poor lifestyle choices were the sole cause of that disease.
Well, would it be easier to control it if someone is in good health or younger and a little fitter, or do the people who tend to have problems, are they less likely to be fit under any circumstance?
A lack of exercise can be a precipitant for developing diabetes in someone who's genetically at risk, and patients who follow a less healthy diet and don't exercise are at higher risk to get diabetes, and it makes it much more difficult to control.
Now, Dr. Lavelle, you said that everyone over 45 should be tested, but you're a pediatrician. What about children? Are there tests that you can give them to find out, and are those tests administered?
There certainly are, and the tests are the same as the ones that are used in adults. And in the case of children, for example, with regard to type 2 diabetes, one would want to know from that family whether there is type 2 diabetes present in the family. Is the child obese? Those would be two of the things that might trigger an immediate look to see whether or not this child was in the early stages of developing type 2 diabetes.
Is this something that also can be developed in pregnancy?
The reversible form of diabetes in pregnancy is called gestational diabetes, and this is something that is extremely common, especially in women who are on the older side, overweight, have family members with type 2 diabetes, but can occur in young, thin women as well. So every woman should be screened with a blood sugar during pregnancy because it's very treatable.
A listener calls to ask about brittle diabetes. What's brittle diabetes?
Brittle diabetes is generally a term that's used more with reference to type 1 than type 2 and means that that individual is producing very little or no insulin and therefore likely to become very hyperglycemic and to develop blood acids or ketoacids very easily. These individuals require very sophisticated and careful management to keep them from going into ketoacidosis.
When is it determined that somebody should take insulin shots? Is that the treatment for most people, or are there certain circumstances that require it?
It's the treatment for virtually all type 1 diabetics, and for type 2 diabetics, when and if they get to the point where their beta cells, the insulin-producing cells, are relatively exhausted.
The treatment actually goes all the way back to the 1920s, doesn't it?
Yes, insulin was discovered just around that time by a Canadian surgeon and a medical student, actually, and the application of the use of insulin began in the early 20s and has continued to this date. There are now formulations of insulin that are longer acting or shorter acting, but fundamentally it remains the mainstay of the management of certainly of type 1 and of many type 2 diabetics.
So we're pretty much doing the same medicine that we've been doing for the last 85 years.
With some embellishments. So over the last 20 years, patients now have the availability of simple tests to monitor their own blood sugar and better insulins that could match the normally secreted insulin, so it's much more feasible to keep the blood sugar normal without overshooting and causing life-threatening low blood sugar. We've developed better tests to give us a 3-month average of blood sugar. That's called a hemoglobin A1C. And normal in a non-diabetic person is under 6%. And if we can help a diabetic person keep the A1C under 7%, the risk of developing a complication is somewhere around 1 in 100 years, not bad odds.
Now, you've said that you no longer are a food, somebody who insists on people eating certain kinds of foods. You've now moved into the exercise camp. Isn't food important here after all? I'd imagine every time you eat something with a lot of sugar in it, you're just exacerbating the situation.
Well, the diet and food plays an enormous part of of treating and controlling both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. As the treatments and the measurements have gotten a lot more sophisticated, increasingly we can help patients eat what they like to eat and enjoy eating within reason and match their treatment to the carbohydrates that they eat. And what they really have control over that they can change is the decision to exercise or not to exercise and how much.
And what does exercise do? Does it build up insulin in the body?
Well, exercise helps transport the sugar that's in everyone's bloodstream more efficiently, capably, and rapidly into the muscles. So it lowers the blood sugar in everybody, allows people to eat more, take less medicine, and have better glucose control and live longer. It's good.
Dr. Leibel, what is the thrifty gene theory?
The thrifty gene theory is the idea that in an evolutionary sense, we have been loaded with genes that would permit us to survive in an environment totally unlike the one that we're living in now. That is, if you think back, say, a million years ago, it would have been an advantage to be able to store energy efficiently in the form of body fat and to be able to respond rapidly to changes in diet that might occur as a result simply of taking advantage of what was available in the environment. Now what's happened is those genes that were presumably selected for in a Darwinian sense during our evolution are now in an environment which we, with our large brains, have actually been able to convert into one in which we don't have to exercise or hunt and can simply pick foods off of a shelf.
So people who lived in environments where there was less available are more likely to genetically have a predisposition? Is that why we see it in Hispanics and African Americans, Native Americans?
That's a sort of broad statement, but in general, that may in fact be related to some of the genetic predisposition of these groups of individuals. The exact reasons for it may differ a little bit, but yes, I think that may be a correct inference.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are Dr. Rudy Leibel and Dr. Robin Goland, co-directors of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia University. Again, 212-433-9692. We're back with Drs. Robin Goland and Rudy Leibel of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia University. We'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to the calls, I just want to ask you about something I read, that ancient doctors used to diagnose diabetes with ants. Is that true? Dr. Goland?
People with poorly controlled diabetes have a very high blood sugar, and the sugar then spills into the urine. And so the sweet urine in ancient times might have attracted ants. So that probably is true.
Huh. Boy, I mean, that is as good as the test that we use now, isn't it?
Not quite.
Okay, let's take some calls. Lynn from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm a diabetic, type 2. And I also have neuropathy in my hands and feet, moderate to severe. I wondered if there are any new paradigms in the pipeline for treating the pain. I'm already taking oral medication, and I don't want to go on narcotics, which seem to be the next way for me. So I'm hoping that there's something new that's coming along.
Dr. Goland?
Sure. Well, as you know, diabetic neuropathy, or the nerve damage that can result from high blood sugar, can be really painful. The good news, which hopefully you've experienced, sometimes it can wax and wane on its own, and so it might get better, even with no particular treatment.
I've had it a long time, and it's not significant, enough to be helpful, yeah.
So there are oral medicines, many of which you've tried. There's a group of investigators at Columbia University that are looking at gene therapy as an experimental treatment for diabetic neuropathy. So there's a lot of reason for hope and optimism that we'll get better treatments. But as you know, this is a difficult problem to treat.
I've been reading recently about possible links between diabetes and Alzheimer's. Is there a link? Do we know?
There was a recent study linking especially poorly controlled blood sugar to increasing incidence of Alzheimer's. And when the blood sugar is high, it stands to reason that patients' memory can be affected. Their sleep is certainly affected, so I'm not surprised by that.
Let's go to Michelle from Ridgewood, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to ask, are there any differences from country to country as to why a person may develop diabetes? I heard recently on a radio program that diabetes is on the increase in India, and a lot of these people don't demonstrate the same kinds of symptoms or precursors that would bring diabetes on, such as overweight.
So one of the very striking things about the prevalence of diabetes is in the various transmigrations that have been well characterized. For example, the movement of Japanese to the United States and other similar migrations. As these occur and as people are brought into an environment like the one in the United States where it's very easy to get food and not much physical activity is required either for work or other activities, the incidence of diabetes in these individuals begins to rise very rapidly. So it looks as if there is genetic predisposition, which exists based on some of the things we were talking about earlier, and that if you get the environment tuned just right, in a negative sense in this case, you can actually bring out the tendency that these individuals have to develop the disease. So that's why there's a great deal of talk about westernization of the diets of cultures outside of the United States, bringing on this predisposition, which can be rather striking in these populations.
Okay, thank you for your call. Now, what about the things that people do to cut down on sugar intake, like sugar substitutes? Does that help at all? Does it matter whether we're talking about refined sugar or the kind of sugar we find in apple juice?
So it turns out the component of the diet that raises the blood sugar isn't just sugar. It's all carbohydrates.
And one one of the enemies?
Pasta, bread, juice, cereal. Most patients with type 2 diabetes learn to limit, but not completely eliminate, carbohydrates from the diet. And blood sugar monitoring is very helpful because you, for example, could eat pasta and your blood sugar might be fine and somebody else can eat less. Same with rice, same with beans. So it allows the patients to individualize the diet and keep the blood sugar normal.
So the Atkins diet might be good at least for diabetics?
Well, we try to individualize to everybody. And so often patients have trouble over the long term eliminating carbohydrates, and we like them to eat vegetables and fruit as well.
And if they are taking insulin shots, are they overcoming the intake of those things?
Well, when patients take insulin shots, if they take long-acting insulin, then that mostly goes to suppress the liver's output of sugar, which could be accelerated in diabetes. If they take short-acting insulin, we teach them to match the insulin right before the meal to the number of carbohydrates that they're going to eat.
This is an important point, actually, that Robin mentioned that I think many people are unaware of, and that is that a lot of the sugar that's in the blood, this is primarily glucose, actually is produced by the liver. It doesn't only come from the diet. And even if you're fasting, your liver can generate large amounts of glucose.
And we're converting those carbohydrates into sugar naturally?
So carbohydrates often contain glucose as part of the composition of the carbohydrate, but the other elements of the diet, for example, proteins, can actually be converted into carbohydrate as well, and fat can displace some of the components of the diet to increase glucose production. And in fact, in a fasted individual, overnight, most of the glucose in your blood is actually being made for you. You haven't ingested it.
the body does that as a natural way of getting you through.
Sure.
When you're fasting.
Absolutely.
So
right.
the thing that we're doing that is a very positive thing works in a very negative way for somebody who has diabetes.
It can. And in fact, insulin is one of the major mediators of how much glucose the liver is going to provide. And that's why balancing the insulin dose is so critical to controlling the amount of blood sugar. Right.
And that brings us back to the guilt and blame, that if a patient is waking up with a very high blood sugar, they're not eating in general in the middle of the night. It's not their fault.
Milton, hi, you're on the air. Milton, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I just have two quick questions. What is the purpose of testing your blood if you're not taking insulin? I mean, are you supposed to know how food affects your body and therefore change the medication? And the other question I had was, how does hypo and hyperglycemia affect a diabetic?
So the purpose of blood sugar monitoring, whether or not somebody takes insulin, is to help make sure that whatever treatment you're having, and that could be exercise, changing your diet, oral medication, that it's working properly. And often I find that patients go overboard in limiting what they eat, and they actually might find out that they don't need to be quite so strict to keep the blood sugar in a good range. And hyperglycemia is if the blood sugar is too high, and we like the blood sugar to be in range 80% of the time. And the other 20%, it's not a perfect world, and it's not going to hurt you anyway. And we certainly want to avoid low blood sugar because that could be very dangerous.
Are these things that are easily monitored at home, or do we have to keep on going to the doctor?
They're all very easily monitored at home with tests that take 3 to 5 seconds.
My guests are the co-directors of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Medical Center at Columbia University, Dr. Robin Gulland and Dr. Rudy Leibel. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Anda from Edison, New Jersey. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about why America is spending, let's say, about 100 times more than the rest of the world together, but with the least results. And second, about more clinical trial with non-invasive glucose monitoring for children. Why is not happening as fast as we would like? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we certainly share your sense of urgency that to develop non-invasive ways to check the blood sugar would be really desirable. It's uncomfortable, it hurts, and it would be better if there were a way to get a reading by infrared without having to prick the finger and get a drop of blood. There are trials going on. Often they do involve adults to begin with, and there are some slightly less invasive ways to check the blood sugar coming down the pike, but none available for children yet.
Dan from Irvington, New York, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
For years, I'm a type 2 diabetic. For years, I've been doing the A1C, I believe it's called, for the 90-day check of my blood sugars, and it's never really jived with what my personal feelings and averages were on my daily testing. So we started doing a test called fructosamine, which now shows that I wasn't quite as well controlled as that first test had been showing. Can you explain that difference to me?
So there are several tests to figure out how much sugar is in the blood. Since we have sugar in the blood 24/7, and even if you're testing your blood sugar 5 times a day, 10 times a day, that gives a very imprecise snapshot of what the average blood sugar is all day long. The hemoglobin A1C is one reflection. It's a 90-day reflection, and depending on the kind of hemoglobin people have, the protein in the blood, that is a better or worse reflection, and the fructosamine is just another way to get that average.
Thank you so much for your call. Nancy from Manhattan, you're on New York Public Radio.
Yes, hi, how are you? I have two questions. I'm a type 2 diabetic, and I became diabetic in my 40s, and I was physically fit. I wasn't overweight. I worked out. I was very healthy, but I went through a very stressful divorce. And after my divorce was over, I became diabetic. And according to my doctor, stress can be a factor in becoming a diabetic. Is that true?
Stress certainly raises the blood sugar in everybody, and in somebody with any genetic predisposition to type 2 diabetes, it could certainly precipitate it or unmask it. It's important to recognize that about 20% of people with type 2 diabetes are not overweight.
Stress seems to be a problem for about 90% of all the medical conditions we have. It can be cancer, it can be diabetes. Well, but we live in a stressful world. Do you think it's one of the reasons we're seeing increases in those illnesses?
The with regard to diabetes, at least, there's one of the most direct connections between stress and blood sugar. That is, there are many hormones in the body that are set up as so-called counter-regulatory devices to prevent the blood sugar from getting too low, which is quite dangerous, as Robin mentioned. And stress activates these hormones in such a way as to raise the blood sugar. So there, I think the connection is probably quite direct.
We have a listener who is concerned that because she has type 1, she doesn't like being lumped with type 2. It sort of suggests that she has a lifestyle problem when it's really something else. Is this something that people in the diabetes world actually argue over?
I think there are certainly differences between patients with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. As Rudy said, both illnesses can and do eventuate with the blood sugar being too high. How somebody with type 1 diabetes got diabetes is through an autoimmune attack, an assault on the beta cells. They must take insulin to survive. And for patients with type 1 diabetes, managing their diet and their exercise is essential but cannot substitute for insulin. And in type 2 diabetes, many patients can, in fact, take no medications and certainly no insulin and just completely manage the disease with diet and exercise alone.
Abby from New Jersey. Hi, you're on New York Public Radio.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and you?
Good, thanks. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I've recently been interested in the correlation between diabetes and eating disorders. I'm 20 years old, and I've found a bit of information that there is a strong association, and I'm wondering, have you seen some of this in your at the Barry Foundation, or you know, is there research into this?
Are you talking about anorexia and
bulimia?
And bulimia?
Yes, those I found around young women in my age, but also I guess there is a correlation between compulsive overeating and type 2 diabetics, but I'm more concerned about the first.
There is a lot of evidence that eating disorders are increased in patients, you know, especially young women with type 1 diabetes. This is the age group and the gender that is affected by eating disorders more. And it's logical to conclude that we perhaps exacerbate this risk by paying so much attention to teaching the patient to control what they eat and to control their weight. And there have been several studies linking the two. It makes the diabetes extremely difficult to manage.
We are seeing a major increase in diabetes around the world, 171 million worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. There are projections that it will double in the next 25 years or so. Is this simply because the American lifestyle is becoming more and more common throughout the world?
Well, one thing it's probably not due to, at least as best we can tell, it's not due to change in people's genes. That doesn't happen that rapidly. So it must be due to some environmental factor or factors. And the most clearly implicated, although not definitively proven, is a change in the availability of calories, easily got and without much physical activity. But there may be other factors as well. There may be influences during gestation and other environmental processes that we're not aware of. But clearly, there's something has changed in the environment.
This is an odd aspect of American hegemony, isn't it? Chris from Greenwich, Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Since we just were talking about gestational pregnancy, gestational reasons, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I had gestational diabetes with two of my three pregnancies. Both were insulin dependent. I also have my maternal grandmother who has type 1 and my paternal grandmother who has type 2 diabetes. And I was curious what my risk factor for the future as well as my children would be.
So this is a really important question. And women with gestational diabetes, the form of diabetes that comes on in the third trimester and goes away within 20 minutes, half an hour of delivery of the placenta, in many studies they're at about 50% of them develop type 2 diabetes in the next 5 to 10 years. And this is a risk that can be reduced but not completely eliminated by getting back to a normal pre-pregnancy weight and exercising.
Mm-hmm. Okay, because that's one of the things that that I've struggled to come to grips with, that I know that I want to prevent this since I know I think my risk factors from both ends are pretty high.
Right. Very important to get your blood sugar checked every year and make sure that it's normal and exercise.
And we go ahead.
Risk to the child, which you asked about, is also significant here. So even without any major predisposition within the family, just being the product of a diabetic gestation increases the child's risk. And the fact that you have diabetes in the family anyway increases it further.
Thanks to both my guests, Dr. Rudy Leibel and Dr. Robin Goland of the Naomi Berry Diabetes Center at Columbia Medical Center. Thank you so much.